You're listening to the podcast for Inforum, an innovation lab at the Commonwealth Club. Buy tickets to upcoming live events in San Francisco at inforumsf.org. Want even more Inforum? Find us on Twitter, Facebook, and Instagram as InforumSF.
Good evening, everyone, and welcome everybody to tonight's program with Inforum at the Commonwealth Club. My name is Mohamed Fahmy, and I'm the co-regional managing director of First Republic San Francisco Region. We're pleased to support tonight's program. First Republic has a longstanding commitment to the Commonwealth Club, and we really support this organization for the great work it does. For tonight, as many of you know, San Francisco is a city of innovation, and we constantly make national headlines with companies going public or being acquired or liquidity events being created. And through many of these changes, little is being discussed to equip the employees of the companies on what the major cultural shifts or shifts that are going to happen once a liquidity event happens or the company gets acquired. We wanted to address these shifts and bring together a panel of experts to share their insights tonight. Please welcome tonight's panelist, Lise Beyer, founder and partner, Class 5 Group; Tracy Cote, Chief People's Officer at Genesis; David Rosenthal, General Partner at Wave Capital and host of the Acquired podcast; Dan Springer, CEO and founder of DocuSign. We're excited to have them here tonight. Ladies and gentlemen, please join me in welcoming them to the Commonwealth Club.
Oh, Lord. All right. Thank you. Can everybody hear me okay?
Yeah.
Okay, great. Well, welcome, everyone. Thank you, everyone, for coming. This is a great great turnout. So I'm David Rosenthal. As Mohamed said, I'm a venture capitalist at Wave Capital here in San Francisco, which is a early stage VC firm that I started 2 years ago with two partners who are early employees at Airbnb. But more importantly, I'm the co-host of the Acquired podcast as my hobby on the side. So you probably are more interested in hearing my perspective from that area tonight. That brings us to the topic of life after liquidity. Tracy, Dan, and Lise, thank you so much for joining us. So just to set the stage, if you've ever listened to Acquired, you know that I like to be very verbose and go back in history to kind of set the stage for each episode. So kind of to do that briefly here, it might be sort of tough to remember sitting here in September 2019, but not too long ago, the dominant trend in Silicon Valley was stay private longer, coined by famed venture capitalist Bill Gurley. Most high-growth tech companies were choosing not to go public after, you know, 5, 7, even 10 years of high growth, as they ordinarily would have in previous eras, and instead taking hundreds of millions of dollars in private capital as new unicorn companies from often new entrants into the venture funding market. And I was thinking about this, and I remembered when I was in business school, I got to meet the late Dave Goldberg at an event, who was at the time CEO of SurveyMonkey. And he had publicly stated that he was never going to take SurveyMonkey public. He was going to keep it as a private company forever. And I sort of asked him, I was a venture capitalist before business school, and I was planning to go back into the industry afterwards. And so I sort of knew how, you know, the math of venture worked. And I was like, are you sure? Like, how long are you going to stay private? And I thought, you know, well, we'll see how long that lasts. And it turned out it lasted a really long time. SurveyMonkey did go public last year in 2018, almost 20 years after the company was founded. And we can talk about this with Dan a little bit. DocuSign, not quite as long, but almost as long. So, you know, what's happened and what's enabled that? You have all this capital that's flooded into the private ecosystem, the private tech company ecosystem, best exemplified by SoftBank and their Vision Fund, which, you know, I think gets lost in all the news about SoftBank, but it is actually the largest fund of any type in the world, $93 billion dedicated to investing in private capital. So bigger than any private equity fund, any real estate fund, any other asset class out there in the world. And that's fueled all of this that is now coming to an end, because no trend lasts forever. And so here we are now. And so far this year, Lyft, Uber, Pinterest, Slack, Zoom, last year, Spotify, Dropbox, and of course DocuSign have all gone public. Many more companies have lined up to go public. Airbnb maybe at some point soon here. And that's kind of changed things because Silicon Valley has been architected for these private companies over the last few years, from management teams to employees to investors. And now here we are with all of this liquidity. And the question is, well, what does life look like after it? So that's what we're here to talk about today. I thought I'm going to open up the panel to discussions in a minute, but to start, I thought I might start with each of our panelists individually and ask them kind of a few questions about their perspective. And then also, as mentioned on the comment cards, please write down your questions and we'll make sure we have plenty of time for them at the end. So I want to start with Tracy. So you're the chief people officer at Genesis. Unlike a lot of these other companies out there, you guys have taken a bit of a different path to liquidity that I want to talk about. You've done two separate transactions with private equity firms, first in 2012 with Permira and TCV, and then in 2016 with Hellman & Friedman, locally here in San Francisco. How has kind of that been for you all versus, like, I'm sure you could have gone public and tapped the public markets. How has that experience been?
So I think there's people don't think about private equity transactions as being liquidity events. Really, people don't know about that. IPOs are what gets all the press and it's all the excitement. But private equity is it's a different kind of transaction, but it's still a transaction. So Genesis, the company I currently work for, in 2012, spun out from Alcatel-Lucent, and they were bought by Permira, a European-based private equity firm. And private equity is similar to a venture capital firm, although I think they tend to invest for a little longer and really pick their bets. And in 2016, we had a liquidity event. We could have gone public, decided to instead have a transaction to another private equity firm. So Permira sold half their stake to Hellman & Friedman. And what that resulted in was a liquidity event for people who held stock in the company, much like an IPO.
And so were employees and management able to sell into that transaction as well?
So in private equity, it works a little bit differently. So you hold your stock options to anybody who has them, which isn't always everyone. You hold them until there is an event. And so when there's an event, then whatever you have, you can cash in on it. It tends to not be as lucrative in some instances as going public. And other instances, it can actually be more lucrative. It just depends.
Yeah. So let's talk about your chief people officer. From a kind of recruiting and retention standpoint, when liquidity events happen with privately financed companies, you can obviously potentially get liquidity, but you're competing in the talent market with your peer companies, many of which, like DocuSign, who are public and are able to say to employees, hey, we're going to have regular selling windows for your liquid public stock. What's your answer to that about how you compete with in that market for employees?
Well, I'm not going to lie. It's hard. It's a little hard to compete with because it's much easier to understand. It's a lot sexier. I'm sorry, DocuSign, it's sexier. So you have to explain a private equity system to people. And one of the things that we also do is we recruit maybe a slightly different pool of talent. We cast a wider net. We don't just focus on talent that's in one location, the Bay Area. We focus on talent all over the world. We have employees in 58 countries. So we have a really nice opportunity to be able to recruit wherever we find the best talent. And we have a strong virtual workforce strategy as well. So that also gives us an opportunity and another way to look at what's appealing to employees. It's money's great, but sometimes you want people who are here for the cause, not just for the money. And so we try to create an employee experience that is really worth having, so people want to be there.
Yeah, makes sense. All right, Dan, I want to move to you. So this isn't your first rodeo, taking a company public last year. Congratulations, by the way.
Thank you.
What made you want to sign up and do it again? Your first company, Responsys, you took public in 2014, is that?
We sold in 2013 to Oracle. We went public in 2011. But actually, not in any of the... Google doesn't go back this far, but Lisa and I were involved in the company in 1999 that went public, if you can believe. For you, some of you probably weren't alive yet.
We were both 12.
We were 12. Yeah. Called NextCard. So this is actually the third time that I've done that.
What what made you want to come back and do it again?
I mean, actually, the IPO process is kind of a fun process. There's a lot of enthusiasm and excitement, as you said. It's sort of people put a lot of attention on it, and it does feel a little bit sexy. But I think for me, the experience is really now I've done it. You know, first one, it's about yourself. Second time you're doing it, you start to realize that it's really about other people more than it is about you because you've had that experience. And it's really fun to watch other people go through the process. And people do get very excited. And it also creates good career growth opportunities. So that's another part that you just really get excited about taking people through it. And I would also say that when you do it and you've done it before, you do get to feel like the sage expert a little bit and maybe become a little professorial and tell people, this is what you should do. An example of that is when we got ready to go public at DocuSign, I told people, you know, the temptation is you go public and you start looking at the stock price every day. Mm-hmm. So I made a commitment that I only look at the stock price after it closes once a week on Fridays. Mm-hmm. And it's hard. And to be fair, a lot of times people come and tell me what happened in the stock market. So you do get, you know, bankers come by and tell you what happened on Tuesday. But in general, I won't look myself except for on Fridays. And so you have an opportunity to try to show people, you know, a little bit of maybe the better way or a more thoughtful way. So that's fun about it, too.
Sounds like you might have a third career working with
Lisa, yes.
In the future. But so when you joined DocuSign in 2017, it was only a little over a year until you went public. So I imagine preparations either were already underway or were moving very quickly from the time you joined. How did you get, you know, the public these days, it used to be in the good old days that companies would file to go public with the SEC for their first draft, and then that would be public, and it would be a long process that would play out. Now with confidential filing,
yeah.
S1 only becomes public only a few months before the company actually does the IPO, but the work is many, many months leading up to that. Did you start right away?
We didn't start right away. There were a few things we needed to resolve with the business. As I like to say, DocuSign, when I joined, was a great company, masquerading as a good company. And there were some things we were doing sort of self-inflicted that we needed to sort of fix and clean up before I felt we'd be ready for the sort of public scrutiny. And it is a different scrutiny with, you know, one of the great things about private equity as a model, you have more understanding owners and they're not looking at press releases every day and they can sometimes be demanding, but they also usually can think a little more about the long term. When you're public, you do get on that quarterly cycle and you really need to deliver every quarter. There's good to that, but there's also sometimes challenges if things change in your business. So I really wanted people to be ready. So we spent, after about 3 or 4 months after I joined, we started the process. It was just under a year to say, let's start acting like a public company. Let's start doing quarterly releases ourselves, even though we didn't publish them to anyone else, and just sort of practice that process. So we did that for 3 more quarters. And after 2 quarters, about 6 months before we actually went public, we did our confidential filing. And then about 3 months after that, the beginning of the year, was when we did our first sort of public filing. Although not very many things are private in Silicon Valley. So after our confidential filing, it's amazing how many people came up to me. Hey, congratulations. That's really great. You guys are like, I don't know what you're talking
about.
Well, rumors.
That's a good
thing. Rumors.
Into my last kind of individual question for you. So DocuSign was founded in 2003, actually up in Seattle, not in San Francisco. In those first months when you were joining, you know, what did you have to do culturally for the company to take it from a 15-year-old private software company to be ready to be a high growth, you know, we'll talk in a bit about the current market for valuation market for public SaaS companies, but being in that league, how did you approach that?
Well, so the company was founded by a gentleman named Tom Gonzer in Seattle, and Seattle is still our largest office. Our headquarters is here, but we got a couple hundred more people in Seattle than here. And I grew up in Seattle, so it's great. So I get to go home and see my mom a lot now that I'm at DocuSign. The culture at DocuSign was, a lot of it was fantastic. And the reason it was fantastic, and going back to your employer brand issues, is people like working at DocuSign because our customers love us. And we were talking backstage about this concept. When you meet someone and you say you work at DocuSign, people say, I love DocuSign. I bought my house there. Or you've made my life a lot easier at work. And I contrast that with my life at Responsys, where we were an email marketing company. You meet people and they say, oh, you're the spammers. Permission-based email marketing is what we prefer to say, but I guess you could. You know. So it's a lot nicer when people say, I love DocuSign. So our employees are really happy. We have very low attrition rates, about half of the industry norm, even though most of our employees are in Seattle and San Francisco, which are two very competitive marketplaces, as you know. And people like being here. So that standpoint, the foundation was really strong. There were a couple cultural things that I felt we needed to do, really just to make it a better place, but not really to make it a better place to be public. And as I like to say to people is, after we go public, the only difference I really want to feel is that some information that I used to be totally transparent about, I can't be transparent until after our earnings calls. So I do an all-company quarterly meeting, and now I do it right after the earnings. We had earnings last week, and this week I had the all hands. And then I share all the same information. It's just that we have to wait till the end of the quarter. That was my goal, to not have anything else change.
Cool. All right, so Lisa, I want to move over to you. You've been doing your work for a long time. You helped Google go public back in a previous era. And worked with the legendary Frank Quattrone as well. From your perspective, I gave my little spiel to kick this off, but what happened that put Silicon Valley in this stay private longer mindset for so long?
It was regulatory. It was the Jobs Act, which was pitched. I mean, there are many things that contribute, but the biggest piece was the Jobs Act. Prior to the passage of that act in 2012, when a company had 500 shareholders, and that included option holders who had exercised, it had to publicly file its financial information.
This is what happened to Facebook, right?
It's what happened to Google. It's what happened to Facebook. And the thinking was, if you've got 500 shareholders, maybe you have an obligation to tell them what's going on in the company. And so as companies like Google and Facebook approached 500 people and did all kinds of multiple class structures and things to try to stall. But anyway, as they approached the point where they were going to have to publicly file their information, they said, well, look, we're going to have to put those numbers out there. We may as well take advantage of it and go public. And it was actually, in my opinion, a really good thing because companies tend to grow on a curve like this. And prior to the Jobs Act, companies, generalization here, there are certainly exceptions, but they would go public here on the growth curve. Right? Because there was still a lot of room to go. Along comes the Jobs Act, which took away the 500 shareholder rule. And it was, in my opinion, a gift from the venture capital community to the venture capital community. And it said,
certainly in terms of management fees.
Well, just in terms of they could hang on longer. They didn't have to share these rapidly growing companies with the public. And so they did hang on longer. And there's no question it is easier to operate as a private company than it is to be a public company. Now, certainly there are companies like Zenefits and Theranos that, to use extreme examples, it might have benefited from maybe some of the governance structural items that come along with being public. But
I can think of one or two other examples.
There are many others. Yes, maybe we'll get to some of them later in this conversation. But anyway, so that was the biggest thing that changed, is suddenly huge amounts of money could come in while companies were still private.
And so there was another big difference between Google and Facebook and a lot of the IPOs we're seeing now. And this leads to my next question, which is, they were profitable when they went public, very profitable. That is not the case with a lot of companies going public today. In my opinion, that's one of the reasons that has led to the kind of very different receptions for the Zooms, the Slacks, the SaaS companies, the DocuSigns versus the Ubers and the Lyfts and the, some of these more consumer businesses. How do you see the market for investors investing into this new era of IPOs?
You know, investing as an institutional investor, which I did for a long time, it's a continuum. How much risk am I willing to take versus how much reward do I think I can get? And depending on what's happening in the economy writ large, people skew one way or the other. So if you remember back in 2000, companies went public with like a slideshow, two guys and a dog.
I mean, not even revenue, right?
No, eyeballs. Yeah, pre-revenue, exactly. So companies going public before they were profitable isn't anything new. And we just swing back and forth as to whether we're willing to be all excited about them because look what's going to happen. Or now we've got, as you mentioned, Uber. We've got companies, or I'll just throw it out there, WeWork, that have losses that are hard to fathom in terms of just scale. And so we are certainly seeing bigger losses now than we had seen in the past. But again, investors are always back and forth between what's more important to me, aversion, risk aversion, or, but look how much I might make.
Well, what's old is new again. Well, maybe we can talk about some of those companies more with the whole panel, but I want to talk, my last question for you, about direct listings. Spotify did it, Slack did it. You know, Bill Gurley's newest campaign, instead of stay private longer, or decrying stay private longer, is companies and management teams are leaving money on the table with IPOs. Why not do direct listings if you don't need the capital? And the benefits of direct listings are twofold. One, you're directly selling shares, so there's not, you're not issuing new stock, you're not diluting existing shareholders. Two, and this may potentially be self-interested on Bill's part, the shares that are created for the float come from existing shareholders. So if you're an investor in the company, or if you're an employee or the management team, you can sell directly into the IPO instead of a lockup. What's your take on this?
You know, direct listings surely are the shiny new object, and they're right for some companies and not right for others. The biggest difference is that the company itself cannot raise any money.
Yep.
Right? A direct listing, that's technically not completely true, but for all intents and purposes. So direct listings right now are, hey, people who currently own the stock, particularly venture capital firms or others who are early investors, you're just going to toss that sucker out there on a given morning and let's see where it trades. Being a little facetious, but not terribly. The venture guys love it because, again, in combination with the Jobs Act, one, they could hang on longer. But two, they still had this pesky problem of they had to hang on generally 180 days after the IPO. Yeah. Not anymore, not with a direct listing. You sell it and you can get out of Dodge as fast as you want, which at some level gives some folks incentive to hang on right until this happens to the growth curve.
Yep.
And then check out. Now, again, that's a generalization. But so I think we might see some others. I think there are advantages for some companies. The fees are a little less. In all of the incredible enthusiasm right now about direct listings, no one's paying attention to the fact that the two companies that have done it are both trading well below the S&P, well below the NASDAQ, and well below the price where they went public.
Price, yeah.
So they didn't leave a lot of money on the table, but, and this actually is more for you guys, there's the issue of what happens when your employees on, you know, I don't know, July 15th, think that their shares are worth $50 a share, and then in September, they're only worth $25 a share. You got a morale problem.
Yeah.
So direct listings are good for some and not others. They are certainly not a panacea.
Yeah. So you don't think we're going to see everybody move?
I think everybody's talking about them,
yeah.
But nobody's looking at what the stocks that have done it have done.
So now I want to open it up to Tracy and to Dan. Tracy, going forward in the future, if you and your private equity backers were to consider the public markets at some point in time, do you think a direct listing would make your job and easier or harder, kind of, to Lisa's point here?
Well, listening to what she just said, I'm not sure it's such a great idea. So that would probably not be up to me to decide, right? I mean, the investors would have to make a decision about that. I think there's obviously some flexibility in there, which is very, really interesting. I don't think it's something people kind of down at the lower levels in an organization are thinking about. People just think IPO, and that's so exciting. So it is going to be interesting to see where that goes in the future, particularly as we head into this, the elections and like an uncertain season for IPOs and other kinds of transactions. Like, is that going to be an answer for people?
Dan, if you could go back. Well, I should ask the question literally. Did you consider a direct listing or was it IPO all the way for you all?
We never considered a direct listing. I did a little bit at Responsys because we fit the model that that Lise described of we didn't need to raise any money. We didn't want to dilute ourselves very much. So we actually went out with a very small sale, which is actually not always the best thing because you get what's called a small float. And then your stock can be a little bit more volatile because it just aren't that many shares. So we didn't want to sell them. But the big reason I'm not a fan, and there are certain situations where I absolutely think it could be appropriate. But for most companies, I do think there is some diligence. Investment bankers provide just a tiny bit of value for the public around the diligence that they do that you just don't really have to do. You have to pay them a significant fee for that, one would argue, in terms of that spread. But the second piece is that I don't think it's a bad thing to have happy shareholders. And so if you get this pop, everyone's sort of against that there's going to be some pop in your IPO. If I wake up 6 months later and a year later and everything didn't go perfectly, as we've seen for some companies, it's not the worst thing to have shareholders say, actually, I got in down here. And if you only sell a small part, then the pop isn't so bad because it's only a small piece of the shares that you sold that people make a little extra money. So I try to take a longer term perspective, and I love happy shareholders. And I'm okay if they get a little bit of that pot. When we went public, we listed at $29 a share, and then the trades ended in the high 30s, mid to high 30s. And I looked at it and I said, I'm happy. And my employees were super happy because they said we had a successful IPO and the fact that the stock went up. And, you know, I don't know, $60 a share, 56 last Friday. I don't know what it is today. I only look on Fridays.
It's Thursday, right.
Yeah. But it was tomorrow. I'll find out.
Yeah.
Someone just said 62. That's even better than 56. All right.
You only look on Fridays. So.
I'll find out tomorrow. Yeah. Someone just yelled it out. I don't know. But I can't. I mean, come on. I'm only someone. What can I do? But I do think that's how we look at it.
So, Liz, you were part of one of the most famous, perhaps the most famous alternative listing vehicle, which was Google itself with the, was it a Dutch auction or a reverse Dutch auction?
No, it was a Dutch auction.
Dutch auction.
Or technically a dirty Dutch auction.
So you were actually part of Google as this was happening. Like, how did, you know, this was an era where, well, the first direct listing, actually, I believe, if I'm remembering my history correctly, was Ben & Jerry's ice cream, I think back in like the 60s or 70s. They pioneered the actual structure, but it obviously has fallen out of favor for a long time since then. Google was the first real, like, big time alternative structure IPO
in the US.
In the US, yeah. How did you all think about doing that?
The founders said, we're going to do something different. And we all smiled and nodded and said, okay. The founders were concerned about two things. One was too big a pop, because when you have a company like Google or Twitter or LinkedIn or Facebook or Airbnb, or you get a lot of people investing who don't usually invest in the stock market. And sometimes, whereas professional investors by and large say, hey, look, I'm in at 20, but I'm not paying 28. Sometimes folks who aren't quite as sophisticated on the investor front just say, buy me shares. And so you get a stock that does this. And so we were certainly trying to avoid that a little bit. But the other thing was the founders didn't like the fact that the banks had the reputation of allocating shares to their favorite accounts. So they took that control away from the banks. Sort of the quick primer is, in a traditional IPO, the company and the banks, to some extent, will control both who gets the shares and what the price is. With an auction, you can't control who gets the shares, because it's anybody who was going to hit that price is going to get shares, but you get to control what that price is. And with a direct listing, you don't control the price and you don't control who owns it, is in a very generalized way.
Was part of the Dutch auction is actually also how Google's ad business operates, right? Was that part of the thinking?
Absolutely. Google argued that we're one of the biggest auction houses in the world. They did, I don't know what the number was at the time, but millions of auctions every day. If it was good enough to run our business, why wasn't it good enough to sell the stock? And the second thing was, and this goes to Sergey and Larry, they felt really strongly that the shares should go to the individuals who used Google as much as they should go to big institutions, ignoring the fact that the big institutions are actually the aggregated funds of lots of individuals, but we won't go there. But anyway, they wanted to make sure that everybody had an equal, anyone who was willing to pay the price had an equal shot at getting shares.
Yep.
And so when I said dirty Dutch auction, that just meant when you do an auction, you say we're selling 100 shares. At what price can we sell 100 shares? That would be a pure Dutch auction. We had the ability to drop the price below where supply exactly equaled demand, as long as everybody, whether it was Fidelity or, you know, old McDonald, would get the same percentage shares that they looked for, as long as they met the price, more than you wanted to know.
And that, I would presume part of the thinking on that was that so you could get the pop even though you were optimizing for...
It was to make sure that we didn't have a gazillion individuals going, I'll pay $800 a share.
Yeah.
We wanted to make sure that we could keep the price at a level where the big professional investors were also going to be shareholders.
You're listening to a podcast of Inforum, an innovation lab at the Commonwealth Club. Support our podcast and find out about upcoming live events in San Francisco at inforumsf.org.
I'm going to take a question from the audience here, because I think this is a good one. And on topic here, which is the question is, what do you think the repercussions are of going public against potentially against the wishes of major investors? For instance, as what is being discussed with WeWork and SoftBank right now, or at least being reported in the press. But maybe as a more general question, like, and self-interested as a VC, you don't always see eye to eye as a management team and employees versus an investor base on when you want to go public and get liquidity. How did you manage this?
Well, so it's interesting because the vast majority of the cases that I've experienced and talked to other people about, it's the other way around, where a management team says, yeah, we're not sure we're ready. I don't really want to do that. And some investors say liquidity. I think you guys should start life after liquidity right now, to use the title of your session today. So usually it's the other way around. But I mean, I think this is one of the situations where you have a board. Different people have rights to be there because they're management. Some people have rights to be there because they were founders. Some people because they invested money. And I think that's one of the challenges, of our structure, is you have to find that medium. Rarely do I see it come down to a voting discussion. Well, I have this many shares of that. You do have to get consensus and get people to go forward. I think my current guess, I've only had one conversation, with Adam about this from a WeWork standpoint, and this was before, so not based on any of the information that's come out with SoftBank. They want to go public. They want to be public. They also do need to raise billions of dollars to continue to run their business, which could be done other ways. But I think they're going to do it, and I think their investors will, in the end, support them. SoftBank has a quite unusual situation in that they invested at a much higher price. And so if they do go public at a lower price, they'll have to write down their investments. And as you know, when you're a venture capitalist and you're out raising money, as SoftBank right now,
yeah,
it's not great to be able to say my last investment fund didn't do as well as it did if I kept it at the higher valuation. So they have an understandable reason to request them not to go out if the price is going to be where the price is going to be. So I think it's, both perspectives are reasonable. I think Adam has enough control of that business that they will go. Oh. That's my forecast.
Well, I think something that's interesting, if I can add to that, is I think if you took a vote, most employees would vote to go public 9 times out of 10. They all want to do it. They're excited. They ask in every all hands meeting, are we going public? When's it happening? And sometimes even the management team is interested in that, with the caveat that living quarter to quarter is a little bit scary sometimes. But what's interesting is the investors tend to be, whoever is owning you tends to be, at least in PE, a little more conservative. Right. They want to make a sure bet, and going public's never a sure bet. You don't know exactly what's going to happen. You can't predict that. There's no crystal ball. So I think where you see PE doing, sometimes they'll take companies public, but much less often, I think, than venture capital firms, which is interesting to me. They tend to sell to strategics or sell to other. They trade companies around the PE circuit a little bit. I see that, too. Less often than going public. And maybe that will change as the bridge between VC firms and PE firms gets smaller and smaller.
Well, and that brings up an interesting point. Maybe Lise, you could talk a little bit about, I don't see this as much anymore, but if you rewind 3 to 5 years, when a lot of PE firms were coming into the private company venture market, they were issuing, dirty term sheets. Pure play VCs called them, and these dirty term sheets had ratchets in them, where if the company did go public at a valuation sometimes lower than the valuation of the investment, but sometimes even at multiples higher than that, then these investors would get essentially a true up of more shares to guarantee them a return. So we saw this in the Square IPO. Square actually went public, again, hard to remember now, at a lower valuation than their last private round. And so a bunch of these ratchets got triggered. And then within a year, Square was performing incredibly well. The stock was up hugely, and these investors made huge returns on the public markets. Lisa, what was going on in the markets at that point in time?
Sometimes, again, when people are more focused on risk, they want the VCs have all the power, or the VCs or the PE firms have all the power, and they can put in these
the last
ratchets.
Money in. Has
And the frustrating thing about ratchets is, so the sort of the quick story about the ratchet is, you tell me what you want to be worth. No, I'll do it to you. You're the CEO. You tell me what you want to be worth, and I'll tell you what it'll cost you. So you want me to tell you that you're worth $1 million? You're worth $1 million. But if you go public and you're worth less than $1 million, you're going to pay me so that it looked like I made money anyway. And what's so unfortunate about it is the people who get... I'm on stage. I should be polite. The people
poorly treated.
Poorly treated. Thank you very much. People who get poorly treated are the common shareholders, the employees, because they don't get the extra shares. They don't. They get diluted, and so it's really kind of very unfair to them. But again, the VCs and the private equity firms, sometimes it's their own money. Sometimes they're investing for their own limited partners, and their job is to make as much money as they can for the people who've invested in them. So there's no good guy and bad guy per se, except every time the little guy gets treated poorly, it's unfortunate.
Yeah. And I think the other thing to keep in mind, a lot of times that's happening because the folks taking the investment said, I want a very high valuation.
Right. Mm-hmm.
And so if you say, and this is where I think you're so right about the common shareholders who are usually the employees, sometimes the founders too, though they can get hurt by that as well. They start believing these valuations because someone else got that multiple or they sent down the street and they want that high valuation and they think they're actually getting richer. They're not actually getting richer. They're paper, you know, numbers.
I mean, if anything, they're increasing their liquidity
preference. But they're actually increasing their liquidity preference. That's exactly right.
And for folks who don't know, liquidity preference. So traditionally, when you're raising money as a private venture-backed company, in almost every case, the amount of money you raise, that has to get returned to the investors before founders and employees make anything. Now, that's in a acquisition of the company, not in an IPO. And so what was really interesting about these ratchets is they were a way, you know, so traditionally management teams were incentivized to go public, not sell the company, because then that would wash away this liquidity preference that the investors had. Yeah. Ratchets were a way to kind of bring that into IPOs as well, which is really interesting.
Yeah, you tell me the value, I'll tell you the terms.
Yeah. So this is a good one from the audience here. And relevant to everybody on the panel, when you're planning a media strategy for an IPO, there's kind of two aspects of communications. There's external communications, of course, to investors, to the press, to the street, to analysts. Then there's internal communications to employees. How do you balance those? Because while obviously you want to have one unified message, which is this is a great company. You want a lot of excitement on the external side, but maybe some more sobriety and on the internal side. What's the balance of those two?
Can I do the quick external and then over to you for internal? The quick external is you are so restricted in what you can do that you can't do very much at all. You've got to be very, very careful because it's a little bit tricky because if you are promoting your stock, or it's sort of known as gun jumping or hyping the stock, and the SEC can smack you on the wrist as they did to Salesforce.com, for instance, when it went public and said, you are making too much noise and you are hyping this deal, so zip it and put your thing back 6 months. So you've got to be very careful. And the hardest part about that is the SEC will sometimes slap you on the hands and sometimes they won't. Uber was out there broadcasting left, right, and center and nobody said a word. But the more interesting part is how you deal with it internally.
Yeah, and I would just say the best way I always articulate the external side is if you look at the prospectus, the S1 that you file, it's about this much information is called, here's our strategy and our business, what we're doing. And the risks section is this long. And people come up with risks that you could not even imagine. They become actually useless documents.
I've always had a question about this.
Yeah.
Who comes up with all the risks?
So what you do is you look at the last IPO.
Mm-hmm.
There's not a lot of creativity. You take a look at their list. And then you look at, give me the last 20 IPOs. You look at all their lists. You add them all in. And then you spend, like the lawyers spend about an hour and a half sitting around going, what else could happen in the world? Yeah. So that's how you come up with the risk list. And that's why it's very focused on conservative. But in terms of the employee side, and I don't think it's probably very different about when you're actually doing a private equity thing, you have the same kind of communications. And I think that you try to have a balance, right? You want to tell people this is exciting. Again, in my situation, as you know, you talked about the idea that people are all saying, I want an IPO. I joined and there were quite a few people who had been promised at DocuSign an IPO for a few years. So there was a lot of enthusiasm to have it happen. Probably, I guess I'd say some pressure too to try to do it in a post-haste way.
Had there been secondary sales at DocuSign?
There had been, yeah. Most companies at that scale, DocuSign raised over $500 million. So there had been a lot of investment and there was a reasonably free market. But that only really affects a small number of insiders. Usually people that are have small, your other, most of your employees have small numbers of shares. They don't really have a wherewithal to find that for most of them. So they hadn't had that benefit. It was mostly former employees who had big shares that ended up taking advantage of that option. But I think you want to get people excited about that, but you also want to, you know, manage expectations so you don't have people that are disappointed. So I actually try to take a very low-key approach to the internal communications and saying, we're going to be the exact same company the day before, and we're going to be the day after. And in fact, a lot of people talk about these big IPO parties that used to happen a lot, like in the 90s, late 90s. We had some pretty good IPO parties in the late 90s. And then we realized that wasn't probably the best use of those funds.
Well, I have to say to that, so I worked at a company called Organic back in the day.
Yeah.
So we went public in, I'll date myself here, 2000 maybe. And it was a cautionary tale for this very question, which was, we hyped it up. Everybody was so excited. You know, it was just crazy, crazy, and it was all wonderful. And we went public, and then they got delisted in like 2 seconds.
Oh, no.
And it was a disaster, right? Yeah. So it was really tough from an employee morale perspective, right? And to bridge that gap culture, it was just very damaging for the company. And, you know, we had to dig ourselves back out of that.
What a whipsaw. What we did at DocuSign is one of our values is DocuSign Impact, which is giving back to our communities. And so we said we were going to do our party in what we call DocuSign style. So the day of the IPO, we had all of our employees go into our communities across all the offices and do support nonprofits. And everyone was sort of like, oh, this is what our values are. This is what makes sense. I'm sure a little champagne was consumed somewhere during the day, somewhere. You know, I was in New York, but it was a great way to do it. And I made people realize that our values are going to be more enduring than a big party.
I was just going to jump down a little bit of a rabbit hole because it's like my favorite part of internal communications. Did you have to do a reverse split?
No.
Okay. Well, many companies.
But most do. And we did it responsibly, but not.
That's very cool. You didn't have to. So, right, you get to the point with your bankers where you decide what the company's going to, theoretically, where you're going to go out, we're going to be worth X billion dollars or whatever it is. How many shares do we have? Divide that number by the number of shares. And you come up with, okay, the stock should go out at X dollars a share.
$20. It's always, why is it always $20?
And that's the answer, exactly. Because sometimes the math comes out and it says you're going to be worth $4 a share or $5 a share. And nobody wants to go out with a stock price of four or five. So you reduce, simple math, you reduce the number of shares. You do a reverse split. You used to have, you know, two shares and now you have one. And there's nothing more, in a cruel way, entertaining than watching engineers
very cruel
who are mathematicians try to cope with the fact that they used to have 100 shares worth a dollar each, and now they have 50 shares worth $2 each, and who's cheating them?
Yeah.
And people totally lose their minds. You literally have to stand up in front of the room and say, this is a $10 bill. These are two $5 bills. You used to have two $5 bills. Now you have a 10. Everyone who's very angry and thinks they're... Anyway, it's...
But it's just that, so did that happen at Google?
It happens... No, it didn't happen at Google because we were... but it happens...
I could imagine knowing the Google culture that there would have been like a long academic debate about
every
that.
Reverse.
It happens all the time.
But the reason it happens is because people know how many shares they had, and then they all think, since they notice that all stocks seem, for whatever reason, to go out about $20. I mean, not all, but there's a pretty tight range around there.
Yes.
And so they all assume their 100,000 shares are going to be worth $2 million at $20. And then when they say, yeah, we're going out at $20, but you only have half as many shares, they feel they've been robbed.
Yes. A lot of education.
Great.
A lot of education, exactly right.
Well, so the communication question brings me back to my list of questions here, mostly for Dan, but for the whole panel. What is the process? You know, the quarterly earnings call is the hallmark of being a public company. What's the process like to prepare for one of those? And especially, you know, for folks who might be on a management team of a company that might go public one day, like that's a whole amount of overhead that, you know, I like to think that I'm tough on my portfolio CEOs in board meetings every quarter, but it's not quite the same level of scrutiny. How early before the call do you start preparing?
So I have to tell the truth or not? So it depends, and it depends a lot on your company and the situation and the quarter. If you don't have anything that's highly unusual, either good or bad, and you have a really good CFO, as I do now, a very experienced CFO in Mike Sheridan, I mean, people, there's meetings, and I sometimes come into a meeting and they'll ask, oh, should we announce this partnership or that? I don't really do very much. And then someone gives me a script draft, usually the calls are Tuesday, Wednesday, or Thursday. I usually get it for the weekend, and I look at it, and I look, well, it seems pretty good. I change words for like the way I speak, and then that's it. There's not a lot of preparation. At Response,
that speaks to the importance of having a really good team place to be ready for this.
At Response, I had a first-time public CFO. I'd taken companies public he never had, and although Chris was a good CFO, he was very nervous, and so I ended up doing a lot of the writing of the scripts. But now I do very little of it. Many companies actually record in advance. That's becoming much more common. They do Q&A afterwards, but they might do it like 3 or 4 days beforehand. They just do record it, and then they just play it when the thing starts, and then when it's over, they do Q&A. So I don't find it to be a particularly difficult thing. There are situations where you can have either way, and you know, I'll give you an example. The last two quarters that were tricky for us. Last quarter, we had one of our metrics, which is called billings, which was in our range, right in the middle of the range we said we were going to have. But people expect companies that are trading at 10, 11 times revenue, which is still crazy to think of how we trade now. It's about $1 billion in revenue, and we're worth about $11 billion. They expect you to beat all those numbers and then raise the goal. And so we kind of came with one metric in the middle, and our stock dramatically went down. So we had to plan how we wanted to talk about it. This quarter, last week, we announced, and that number that was a little bit low, it was 27% growth, was 47%. And the reality is it's a number that moves around a lot, and you don't really want people to overreact the other way. Because volatility, back to your employee point, it's not really good for employees to have the stock going, because then they start looking at the stock every day as opposed to focus on delivering value to customers. So you then sometimes have to manage that. And you call it downsell. You go, I know that number looked really good. But there are a whole bunch of one-off things that happen. We pulled forward you try to come up with whatever you can to sort of get people not too excited about it. So there's some of those things. But unless you have something like that, it's pretty straightforward.
It's like with most things, lender calls, your board meetings, conversation with your principal, your boss, whatever. If things are going well, it's going to be easy. If things not going well, it's going to be hard.
Yeah.
That's exactly right.
So let's talk about the fact, not DocuSign specifically, because we can't really talk about that, or I assume you can't talk about that, SaaS companies are trading, you know, on average at 10x plus revenue right now. So for folks in the audience who maybe aren't familiar with these terms, a multiple of earnings is typically how companies would trade in the past. People talk about a PE ratio, price to earnings ratio. That was the stock price divided by the earnings per share, net income earnings that the company would make. We're well past those days now. We're trading on revenue, top line, multiples of revenue. 10x revenue is historically an incredibly high valuation, and now that's the norm expectation for a SaaS company. Maybe, Liz, what for investors in the IPO market, public investors, what has made them so bullish on this current generation of SaaS companies?
Two answers. Remember, it's always a continuum. Am I afraid or do I go for reward? Is it risk reward? So we've been in this booming economy that makes everyone feel more comfortable. But I think the other big issue is when I'm an institutional investor, I'm T. Rowe Price, you're Fidelity, you're Wellington. My goal isn't to return 8 or 9%. It's to beat you. And we all own DocuSign and Apple and Facebook and Procter & Gamble, whatever it is. So if I'm going to beat you, I've got to own something you don't own. Yeah. And I've got to have enough of it in my portfolio to make just this much difference at the end of the year. So that incents people to be a little braver on the things that are just new to the market, right? New issues are inherently riskier. It used to be why they sold at a discount. And they still are initially marketed, not direct listings, but other ones, at a discount because they're riskier. But there's a huge incentive. And to your point about SaaS companies, it's because so much of that revenue is reliable. It's not like you're selling clothes. It's not like you're selling tractors that you could sell a lot one quarter and none the next quarter. These are subscription businesses.
Yeah.
And so the more of your revenue comes from subscription, the more comfortable I am that you're not going to whiff. Yeah. And if you're not going to whiff, I'll pay you more for non-whiffage.
Yeah.
Well, subscription is, this is the golden chalice or whatever that everybody's looking for, right? It's all about subscriptions. So, I mean, even the company I'm working for, Genesis, we're a premise-based software company moving to the cloud, and it's all about the cloud is really the emphasis because that's where you get the annual recognized revenue. It's much better than over the long term. I mean, you still have great value from your premise customers, but you can have it be a lot more reliable from a subscription perspective.
And growth would be the only other factor. I think that while the subscription, the sort of the guarantee, the comfort of that as being more stable, the reason multiples are very high in certain parts of the business is people want the growth. And when Lisa was saying, I want to outperform someone, they think they're going to get there by buying growth. And software right now is one of the areas where there's just very high growth companies. So we had 41% growth last quarter in our revenue. That's
huge.
Kind of crazy, yeah. So that's why you get these high valuations.
And the markets are huge for this. It's all in the cloud. So it's anywhere, anybody, any place.
I think what's interesting is if you met your business, the private equity investors until very recently, they never looked at revenue multiples, right? They always looked at the EBITDA or some measure of profitability. And one of the hard parts for a lot of the firms now, they're trying to buy these companies, but they're competing with people saying, I'm going to go public. Yeah. If I'm going to go public, I'm going to get this huge multiple. So both corporate takeovers and private equity firms, they're starting now. They still have to go back in their own little decks when they go back to their firms. I worked with a private equity firm for a while, Advent. They have to still do it on a price to earnings or a price to EBITDA, but they can't actually compete unless they pay at the high value of revenue. So it's the new.
And what's interesting, there are a few sort of new breed of tech private equity firms in the Vistas and the Thoma Bravas and the like that are starting to
They've given up the premise that any profitability metric ever coming. They're buying and they're winning the deal.
Yeah, and they're using debt to buy these companies too, which is incredible.
It works until it doesn't.
Well, so this is a good segue. I have two more kind of general topics that I want to cover before we go fully into audience questions. Let's talk about acquisitions. So the two directions I want to talk about here are, one, one of the reasons that's always stated as a rationale for going public is you now have a liquid public stock that you can use as a currency to make acquisitions. Tracy, you guys have made 16 acquisitions since being taken private. So that doesn't necessarily preclude...
You don't have to go public private for an acquisition.
Maybe Dan, like how with the two public companies that you've been CEO of, how does that change the game when you go into the when you have that public company stock when you're talking to potential acquirees?
Yeah, I mean, I think the answer is if you want to do large deals, it's oftentimes really valuable to be able to use the equity.
Yeah,
I've done as a response to this, we did 7 acquisitions. I've only done the one acquisition since DocuSign bought a company called Spring CM last year. And I try to do them all with cash. I actually think my equity is really valuable, and I believe in my business that it's going to be worth more in the future. So I consider my equity dear, and I'd rather use cash if I have enough cash to do it. I haven't done sort of blockbuster, like, mergers of equals where you could never have that much cash sitting on your balance sheet. But I actually think cash is great. The only time you run into a challenge, or I've run into a challenge, where cash isn't as good as equity, although a private company can still use equity.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
It's just the only problem with using equity as a private company. Now you're trying to figure out two things. You have to figure out what your company's worth, and we're going to use our shares, and no one knows exactly what they're worth. With a public company, you can just pull up the paper or... Does anyone even look at the paper? I can't believe I said that.
I know what
you
meant.
You know, this thing where they put the stock prices in newspapers. I know people aren't going to understand that, but it's crazy. But now you have to do it online, of course. And you can see the value. And if you have two private companies, then you have to kind of argue about two different prices. So it's a little more complicated.
I was on the board of Rover.com for many years, and we merged with DogVacay.
Yeah.
And it was a private-to-private merger. And it took, I would say it took 18 months of negotiation just to come up with a relative valuation of the company. We both agreed we wanted to merge.
Yeah.
It was just like, the back and forth of we couldn't pull out our iPhones and look at the stock price.
Right. The one thing I would say that sometimes comes up reasonably frequently is if you're someone that's selling the company doesn't want to have the tax implications of getting cash, they would prefer you use your stock because just the way our tax laws work, it's sort of complicated. But as long as a reasonable portion is done in stock, then they don't have to they can just keep their investment going and they don't have to cash out and pay taxes on it. So that sometimes that happens and you kind of having the stock is really an advantage because that particular seller doesn't want to do it. But other than that, I think a lot of times people say they want stock, but the reality is cash is king to a lot of people. So I think cash can be a very strong incentive. So, I mean, what your experience.
Tracy, for you, in the acquisitions that Genesis has done, How have you thought about your ability to access capital on the cash side or use equity and get relative to the size of transactions that you can do?
Well, you know, honestly, I am the chief people officer. I think a lot more about the employee experience around the acquisitions. That's for you guys and the private equity firms, the bankers to worry more about that. To be honest, I spend, it is almost 100% my job to be that voice for the people, because when you're doing acquisitions, you've got your board and your management team and your bankers, and you've got all these people all thinking about the transaction and the deal. And, you know, it's all important. I mean, that's obviously, it's a deal, but it's not going to be a successful deal if you don't think about the people. And so I actually spend much more of my time thinking about that. Obviously, a big lever is around compensation. So we acquired a public company, and the employees were a big one. And employees were used to getting RSUs and stock, and it was liquid. And then bringing that into the private equity fold was a little bit of a transition for them, right? So lots of communication, lots of education, some bridging programs, things like that to really bring people along until you know, you then override all of that with hopefully a great employee experience, great work, exciting things to do, and great places to take the company.
So then the other side of acquisitions as a public company is sometimes public companies get acquired themselves, as you mentioned, and Dan, your last company at Responsys. How much, and then of course also in the SaaS world, Qualtrics was on file famously to go public and then got acquired at the last minute in the largest SaaS acquisition in history. How much do you guys, maybe Lise, this is a question for you since Dan probably can't speculate too much. How much?
I can about Qualtrics. I can tell you.
Great, we'll talk about Qualtrics.
I was with Ryan and Bill the week before they did the deal, so I'm plenty of speculation on that.
Oh, okay, great, great. Well, so for everyone then, does being public or being in the process of going public, what is it about that that can increase the attractiveness of the company to a potential acquirer so much?
There's the belief that it's cheaper to buy it today than it's going to be tomorrow is really what it boils down to.
And I don't remember the multiples for the Qualtrics acquisition offhand, but if they were trading at what some of today's public SaaS companies are trading at, I wonder if there would be the valuation would be even 16 higher.
16 times trailing and just over 20 times future. So they Brian got a very high valuation.
Wow.
Yeah, same with Adaptive Insights that was bought out basically 36 hours before they were going to ring the bell, which was really tough from an employee point of view because employees get so excited about it.
Yeah.
They're like, yeah, well, you're going to get cash, which is nice, but you're not going to get to be a public company. And it was actually a real...
Right. Yeah. A lot of times companies, I think, go that route hoping to get bought. They don't really want the volatility and the lack of certainty that an IPO brings. And you put it all out there and somebody gets excited about you and buys you. It happens, I think, quite a lot.
Yeah. And sometimes, to your point at the very beginning of this conversation about when you file your information publicly, sometimes you get purchased before you make that information public because the acquirer doesn't want anyone to know what your numbers really look like.
Yeah.
Okay. So my last topic that also relates to a lot of the questions we've been getting is... what is the impact of this current round of IPOs going to be on the Bay Area as a whole? Especially, you know, you all have lived through multiple rounds of liquidity in Silicon Valley and seen what's happened. What do you think is going to play out this time in terms of, you know, I'll leave the question open to start.
I think we're going to lose the really affordable housing we have here in the Bay Area. I think it's going to be terrible.
The existing affordable housing.
Is there any?
They're going to start, prices are going to go up. It's not going to be so cheap to live here anymore. So I'm really concerned about the degradation we're going to have.
Yeah, but seriously, like, is it just going to get worse? Like, you know, there is now, for the first time again in a long time, a lot of liquidity, significant liquidity in the system in Silicon Valley. Is there any solution to housing prices?
One of the things that, well, not going there, but one of the things that is a little different this time is there have been a lot of secondary sales.
Yeah.
Whereas back in the day, employees couldn't sell until the IPO. Now there are plenty of employees who have at least made some money.
And certainly every, you know, mega unicorn out there, employees have been able to cash out over the years. So.
But, you know, markets are cyclical. Things go up and then they go the other way. So, I don't believe trees always grow to the sky or whatever the phrase is. And I think the bigger question that it has something to do with IPOs, but you look at all the housing being built and wonder, oh my God, what's it? It's going to be like 4 hours to get from Palo Alto to San Francisco. I mean, but
I think there's a, well, I think there's a couple of risks. You know, one is this crisis could start driving companies out of the area, yeah. right? Mm. People...
you already have many employees remote.
Yeah. Right. We're already kind of doing that, right? Just because it's more practical to hire people. And because of all of these great cloud tools like DocuSign, everybody doesn't have to sit in the same office together anymore. Mm. We have Zoom and we have... WebEx,
Slack,
you know, and, all Slack, yeah. whatever. We have all these different kinds of tools to communicate and gather and be a community and just be sitting anywhere we want. So I think that's one thing, right? As housing gets so expensive, our employees want to get out of the Bay Area because they can't afford it and their lifestyle can be so much better elsewhere. And then they can generally command the same salaries because people are just paying for the talent anywhere. That geographic differential in compensation is kind of going away. It's not what it used to be 10 years ago. It's the salary differentials by location are just not what they were. And then I think companies have to contribute to the homeless problem. Like, it's a problem. You see it every day on the street. We have to do something as a community, and there has to be some responsibility there for companies to get involved.
I think it's wonderful on the day you rang the bell that you had your employees go do service in the community.
DocuSign Impact, yeah.
But to the point of remote, I mean, at the early stage end of you know, the venture ecosystem, we invest in seed stage companies at Wave. I don't think there's a single company in our portfolio that doesn't have, and these are companies sometimes as small as like 3-4 people, that doesn't have at least one or multiple remote workers. It's just normal that, you know, wherever you're based, you're going to tap talent markets around the world, even at tiny stages. And that is such a huge change. I mean, even 3 or 4 years ago, as an investor in early stage companies, that was like anathema. As a board member, if you told me you were going to hire remote employees, I'd say you're crazy. You got to wait until you're Genesis or DocuSign stage to be able to do that. And now it's just completely commonplace.
Well, the differentiator for talent is flexibility, right? And for all ages, you've got 5 generations we're in the workforce, right? And everybody wants flexibility for different reasons, but everybody wants it. Yeah. And technology enables you to do that.
I would say the forecasts of the demise of the Bay Area as an attractive place to start and build companies are going to continue to be wrong.
Yeah,
so I totally agree with that.
There's a reason why Wave is in San Francisco.
Yeah.
But I think what's really interesting, and so that brings up the... again, self-interestedly for me as a venture capitalist, the other side of this equation is, will this liquidity and wave of liquidity encourage more people and enable more people who have been employees at these companies for a long time to go become founders themselves? Yeah. You know, we're already starting to see it. You know, by our count at Wave, there have been 18 companies that have, 18 companies started at Airbnb out of Airbnb in the last 2 years. It doesn't really matter because they're not public yet, but Uber has been an incredible generation of entrepreneurial talent. There have been close to 40 companies started by Uber alums just in the last 3 years alone. And so I think it's really exciting to see as these liquidity events happen and enable employees to have a little bit of a nest egg, be able to take risk and go and found companies of their own. It's going to drive, exactly, Dan, to your point, a whole new cycle that's going to kick off here in Silicon Valley.
And the other thing I'll disagree with you on is, that's starting to happen, right? Silicon Valley happened because Fairchild was here.
Yes, of course.
Everything, and then Intel begat everything.
The
cycle.
Interesting is like it. I certainly wouldn't say it's paused. There's been plenty of entrepreneurial activity, but I think there have been a lot of people within these companies that have stayed put because they're waiting for the IPO. Because they're waiting, not for the money, then for just the experience of having done that. So, we are running fairly short on time. So I want to make sure that we end with the traditional Commonwealth Club Inforum question, which is, we have exactly 3 minutes left for each of our panelists. What is your 60-second idea to change the world? Who wants to go first?
Go maybe this way?
Sure, I'll go first. I get to be first. Okay, so I call it the front porch rule. Everyone would be required to hang out on the front porch for an hour a day, preferably after work, no devices, just hang out, weather permitting, with your neighbors and build your community. I think building your community at a local level contributes to tolerance and understanding, and that's what we need in this whole world. And if we start small, I think that could grow.
All right. Dan?
I liked my idea better before I heard your idea.
Yeah, exactly. Boy, you are.
It doesn't have to be serious.
That was good. You get the crown.
So I'm involved with an organization called Pledge 1%. In fact, we just had at the Cloud 100 dinner a couple nights ago, a big focus to try to increase this. And some companies are doing this pledge, and we call it Pledge 1%, where you say your company pledges to have 1% of the time of your people available, so like 3 days a year, tell people that they can still get paid but work in the community and with nonprofit organizations or however they best see fit to do that. 1% of your profits, which people define in slightly different ways, but the idea is that you'll take some of that treasure that you guys are building and give that away. 1% of your products. So we say, as an example of DocuSign, we have 7,000 nonprofits that we let use our software, the vast majority of them for free. If they get really big, we do start to charge them, but at good discounts. And then lastly, and this is really big because it's your point about life after liquidity, is 1% of the equity in the business. So when we went public at DocuSign, our last private round was about $3 billion valuation. So we committed $30 million, or 1% of that equity, to the DocuSign Impact Foundation. And I think if every company would put 1% of their equity into a foundation to be invested in their communities for supporting nonprofits in their community, I think it could be transformational. And we would maybe get a little bit away of businesses sort of being the antithesis of community, so thinking about the homeless problem you brought up as an example, but rather saying, no, the businesses being successful is actually good for our communities, so we're not really kind of going against each other, we're working together. So that's my opinion.
Yeah. Both of yours. Okay, and now we're going from the big to the ex-banker. much more, I don't know what the exact word is, pedestrian. I'd get rid of the Electoral College.
As all, presumably all or most of us citizens of California, we very much support that.
Yeah. Want my vote to count.
That's great. That's all the time we have for the panel. Hopefully folks can stick around for a little while after, but thank you again to Tracy, Dan, and Lise for joining us. This has been great.
And to our moderator.
Thank you. Thank you to... to you all and to First Republic Bank for sponsoring, and we will see you again soon.